And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Matthew DeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought, the show that brings you rationality, critical thinking, and scientific naturalism to the airwaves in the hopes of fostering positive social change. Today, our show is on the recent Supreme Court decision in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby. This 5-4 decision ruled that Hobby Lobby and other privately owned for-profit corporations are exempt from certain laws if that corporation objects to it on religious grounds. Now, later in the show, we'll have two guests with opposing views on the outcome of this case, but the Hobby Lobby decision is complicated, and it goes far beyond an interpretation of the Constitution alone. And it's for that reason that we first welcome Associate Professor of Law at Georgia State University, Ann Tucker. Professor Tucker teaches and researches on corporate law and corporate constitutional rights, something that, I have to admit, we don't talk too often about on this show. And in fact, this may be a first, but it's central to the Hobby Lobby case and will lay a foundation for the second half of today's show. And as it turns out, the subject is actually not nearly as boring as some people might think. So let's get right into it. Welcome to the show, Professor Tucker.
Thank you, Matt. What a great introduction.
Thank you. Glad to have you on. So I kind of want to structure our discussion in a way that identifies the key players in the Hobby Lobby case. And I don't just mean that in terms of specific people, but it includes not only Hobby Lobby, but the Affordable Care Act itself, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the notion of corporate personhood, and the like. So to begin with, as I understand it, the Hobby Lobby case centered around an interpretation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. So first I'll ask, is this correct? And second, can you tell us a little bit about what the act is itself?
Sure. So you're right. The ruling in Hobby Lobby was based on an interpretation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was passed in a bipartisan effort in 1993. And the original statute was passed in response to a Supreme Court opinion in Smith, where the court had held that if a government regulation burdens religion, but that burden wasn't the purpose of the regulation, rather the burden was incidental, then an accommodation isn't required under the First Amendment. And so Congress's response to that Supreme Court precedent was to, in what was thought to be an effort to preserve a robust religious freedom, passed what's known as RFRA. And there's one other important step here, and that is the 1993 Act was amended in 2000 in the Religious Land Use and Institutional Persons Act, and they expanded even further the scope of the regulation, saying it was any exercise of religion, not just exercise of religion occurring under the First Amendment. So that's kind of the statutory framework of the case.
Okay, so I understand that that obviously RFRA had a lot to do with deciding this case. But it seems like the First Amendment of the Constitution, for the most part, didn't really come up, and it was more about RFRA itself. Can you tell us a little bit about why that was the case in dealing with this case?
Sure. So if you think about, I'm going to use an analogy that I like to use, and I hope this plays all right on the radio, but sort of like a Venn diagram, if you will, where you've got a larger included circle and then a smaller area in between, and so RFRA expands the scope of what we would think of as traditional First Amendment protection. So RFRA would be the big circle, and the First Amendment would be the smaller included circle in that Venn diagram. And the idea is that because Congress expanded the protections under the First Amendment through RFRA. And the idea is that if the court decided the issues presented in Hobby Lobby under RFRA, then we wouldn't have to get to the underlying First Amendment claim or the free exercise of religion claim under the First Amendment. Hmm. Perhaps another way to think about it is that the First Amendment in this regard sets the floor, like the minimum standard, and Congress, in passing RFRA, sort of raised that bar or elevated the floor.
Okay, so to your knowledge, did the RFRA itself explicitly define what they meant by person? In other words, was this supposed to include religious freedom for corporations as far as you can tell?
Okay, so this is a great question because this is essentially the first question that the court had to ask and answer, and the first issue that the majority and the dissent disagree with one another on. So there's no explicit definition in RFRA about the definition of the word person. And there is something known as the Dictionary Act that says in the absence of a clear definition or a clear contextual definition, then persons means individuals as well as entities. And so that's the argument that the corporate plaintiffs used to bring the RFRA claim, that we're persons because this isn't defined, and so therefore under the Dictionary Act we get included. The counter argument and the one adopted by Justice Ginsburg in her dissent says that persons is contextually defined in RFRA because a corporation cannot sort of by logical definition exercise religion. So the absence of a clear definition in the RFRA statute was a threshold issue in the case. There were several amicus briefs filed on this, people citing the legislative history both for and against the inclusion of corporations as the intended scope of RFRA.
So I understand that you did participate in one of these amicus briefs. A number of people may not actually know what or remember what an amicus brief is. So can you tell us just a little bit about what that is? And did you touch on, in that amicus brief, did you touch on this idea of corporate personhood as it applies to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act?
Absolutely. Okay, that's a good threshold question. So amicus briefs are filed by parties who are not, or by groups that are not the plaintiff and the defendant or the exact litigants in the particular case, but parties who have an interest in the outcome or who have a particular expertise that they think might help the court in deciding the question at issue. So there were almost a record number of amicus briefs filed in this case. There were over 150 filed.
Wow.
A tremendous amount. So groups from religious organizations to Planned Parenthood to professors to doctors or medical groups and medical associations. You can imagine the wide array of groups that would have an interest in a case that involved the cross-section of business, religion, and reproductive rights. So anybody can file an amicus brief and sort of offer their guidance or their view or what their take of the consequences would be for a particular outcome. And so lots of people took this opportunity in this particular case. I signed on to an amicus brief with a group of other corporate law professors. Ours was not the exclusive academic brief filed, but our view was essentially rejecting the notion of pass-through values, saying that the religious beliefs of the owner should not be passed through and attributed to the corporate entity, arguing that sort of the separateness of the corporate entity from the individual owners should be respected in this situation like it is in situations, say, for example, limited liability, taxes, et cetera.
Right. Now, I'm not sure how specifically you can get into this part of it, but I read the summary of argument in that brief, and I noticed that the term separateness was right near the top. And we're talking again for the listeners about the separateness between a corporation and its shareholders. So can you explain a little bit about perhaps historically, how is this separateness defined? In other words, in what legal ways have corporations and shareholders previously been defined as separate, or has it not even been defined at all?
Okay. Well, this is a really complicated question. And there's lots of nuance and historic. No, but that means you're asking a great question, right? Because it's the hard questions to answer that are usually the ones that get to the heart of the matter. So we're talking about corporations, and corporations are different from sole proprietorships, are different from partnerships, and even some can argue are different from limited liability companies. So in corporations, one of the primary features of the design, the structural design of a corporation, is that its owners exist separate and apart from the corporation. So once the corporation is created, that entity exists under the law in perpetuity, regardless of whether the individual owners die, retire, sell their stock. Corporations are these permanent and separate entities, and that level of permanence and separateness, shielding the death of the corporation from the individual owners, are sort of the two really main features of what makes a corporation a corporation. And there's some instances like the plaintiffs at issue in this case, where we have a limited group of owners, and so we can say, oh, isn't that easy to just take what this group of owners would like to do and attribute that to the corporation and reify the corporation so that it becomes almost like an animate object, right, like a living thing. But we can think of lots of other corporations where ownership is dispersed, where we can think of the ways in which it's hard to assign the interests of the owners to the corporation. And our argument was essentially that rather than drawing these distinctions, we should just stick with the distinction that the law has made, where we hold these groups separate regardless of whether it's a small group of owners or a large group of owners, a privately held company or a publicly held company.
So do you think there's any way in which the plaintiff's argument held somewhat strongly in terms of challenging this idea as keeping the entity of a corporation and its shareholders as being separate? Because I'm having a hard time seeing it.
I'm sorry. I thought I was following your question. You're asking. Can you rephrase the question, please?
Sure. So basically, I'm asking when the plaintiffs tried to when they made the argument that in fact corporations and their shareholders are not quite as separate as case history suggests. Is there any way in which you can see their argument as being valid? Is there any way that we can think about it to consider the argument as being valid itself?
Sure, from the other side. So the idea is that if an individual wants to express their religious views a certain way, the idea is that once they have formed a corporation, they shouldn't have any less ability to express those religious views or any other constitutional rights. So the idea is that if as individuals they do not want to support practices that violate their religious tenets, that once formed as a corporation or organized as a corporation, then they shouldn't be forced to take actions that also violate their religious tenets. The idea is almost borrowed from the related First Amendment right of freedom of association, which allows groups like the ACLU and other groups to form for sort of political and expressive purposes, and that right to form is an important component of the First Amendment, and the theory that says these individuals should be able to organize as a corporation and not lose any of their protections kind of borrows from that freedom of association corollary right under the First Amendment.
Okay, and so it does come up then that obviously the corporations and the people behind the corporations are not the only ones that are granted rights in this case. There's also the issue of the third party, the employees. So how did the arguments go down on both sides regarding the right of the employees to have access to the full health care as provided in the Affordable Care Act?
Right. Okay. So again, this is one of the most interesting and complicated issues in the case. Hobby Lobby alone has 13,000 employees. And the decision in this opinion affects not just those individual employees, but their families that may be getting health insurance benefits under these plans. So
right.
For 13,000 employees, we are looking at an even larger potential pool for just one of the corporate plaintiffs. So I'm going to do my best to be objective on this one, because this is actually the element of the opinion that I have the most difficulty with.
Don't worry. You don't have to be too cautious.
Okay. Thank you. So there's a great line in the majority opinion that sets up this issue. And in fact, when you understand that this is the majority's view of the issue, it's easy to see how they came out. They came out for the religious exemption and against sort of recognizing the rights of the employees. Because they framed the issue in this case as, and I'm going to read from the opinion here, as implicating a difficult and important question of religion and moral philosophy, namely the circumstances under which it is immoral for a person to perform an act that is innocent in itself, but that has the effect of enabling or facilitating the commission of an immoral act by another. So they view the burden imposed on the parties who do not want to violate their religious beliefs as facilitating an immoral act of another. And they consider that burden of facilitating an immoral act to outweigh any right that the employee might have in access to the health care. And again, this is an issue where courts saying that the employer or the corporate employers have protected interests in their religious freedoms under the First Amendment and under RFRA. And we don't have a corollary right that says employees have a right to certain types of health care. And they reject the notion that under the Affordable Care Act, the provision of the contraceptive mandate creates that kind of a right. So in a balancing of interests, the interests of the employers outweighed the interests of the employees. And it's not an insignificant burden for the employees. Justice Ginsburg's dissent outlines many of the facts cited to the court by the various amicus briefs and by the government that detail the 68% increased cost for women of childbearing age and the difficulty of access for 17 million women to get access to contraceptives in this country, and sort of the importance that the contraceptive mandate, the important role that it played in providing a framework under the Affordable Care Act.
So what is it specifically in the Affordable Care Act that encouraged Hobby Lobby to seek relief from the courts? I know that it has something to do specifically with contraceptives, but I understand it's a little more detailed than that.
Okay, you're very good. You're asking great questions.
Thanks. I do my best.
So I mean, you're really getting to the heart of the issues here. So there were four forms of contraceptives that the owners of Hobby Lobby and the other corporate plaintiffs object to, and they are what they consider to be abortion fashion drugs. So they are drugs that prevent the implantation. They prevent implantation even of, say, a fertilized egg. So an IUD, an intrauterine device, would be an example of a device or a medicine that the corporate plaintiffs objected to, because while they are not medically or scientifically considered to be abortion-causing, their individual belief systems reject the science and the medicine and say that they are a form of an abortion and therefore against their religious beliefs.
Huh.
So there were just four types of contraceptives, but here's the issue is they want to limit the access to those types of drugs, including, like I mentioned already, IUDs. IUDs are used for reasons outside of just pregnancy control. They're also used to help women with period-related issues like really heavy flow, cramping, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and a variety of medical reasons why somebody may choose one of these devices that has nothing to do with preventing pregnancy.
Okay. So I guess a follow-up question to that then is, since regardless of how we feel about this ruling, the ruling has been made and the majority has made a decision. So I think that there are many people out there who would say, well, you know, if these people who no longer have access through their employee or through their employer's insurance in order to get these contraceptives, then they could just get them elsewhere. What actually are, to your knowledge, the alternatives as of now for many of these people who would want access to these contraceptives but now have to get them through other means?
So the issue, one of the issues in the case is that the government has created an accommodation program for exempt nonprofit religious organizations. We're going to think of that as like churches and religiously affiliated institutions. And so the government, the argument is that there's an alternative that they can opt into this government program as if they were a nonprofit religious organization, and employees can get the contraceptives through this government program. However, 72 hours after the Hobby Lobby case, in an action filed by Wheaton College, the court granted an emergency injunction that said that nonprofit religious organizations do not have to file the exemption, the form to get to participate in this exemption program, because filing the form triggers employees' access to the abortion-causing drugs, or what they believe to be abortion-causing drugs, and therefore still might pose a burden.
Huh.
So the ruling said, look, you don't have to pay for it because there's this readily available government program that's already set up in place, and all you have to do is file and become a part of this program. And then later that same week, the court said, but filing for this program may also unnecessarily burden or create a burden on the exercise of religion, and so we're going to stay compliance with this pending resolution of that issue.
Huh.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
The ability of an accommodation or access to these contraceptives, that's really called into question right now. So I can't tell you exactly what it's going to be or what these employees should seek, because it's really in flux at the moment.
Well, is the, if I understand right, is the idea that by even allowing the employees of a company to have any option to have access to birth control that has anything to do with the actions of the corporation, that that is something that these employers would oppose, regardless of whether or not it's coming directly from them or their insurers?
So Hobby Lobby and the other corporate plaintiffs didn't raise this issue of filing the form. Another party did.
Right.
We can assume that if they object to paying for it because they don't want to, as the court would say, facilitate the immoral act of another, if they don't want to facilitate it by paying, they also won't want to facilitate it by filing this form. So that's why the availability of this accommodation or the exemption program is really called into question. So it's not an argument raised by Hobby Lobby, but it doesn't take a very difficult step to see how the reasoning extends to corporate plaintiffs or to corporate parties as well.
Wow. So I think we're just about done with our portion, but I'd like to ask you one last question before you go. I understand that you were lucky enough to sit in on the oral argument for this case, and the great thing is that we can all listen to it online now. There's a moving transcript that's available online, which is, it's really a fantastic resource. It's oyez.org. Fantastic. I love using it. But you were actually there. So how did it go? And when you left, did you have any thoughts or guesses as to how the justices might decide the case?
Well, one, it was a great honor and privilege to be able to attend. It was an absolute highlight in my professional life, because it was just being able to see this argument take place in person and see the justices, and it was incredible. There was no question where eight of the justices fell along the line, and each traded sides quite well. So the dissenting justices, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan, really led the battle charge against the Hobby Lobby argument for the first 30 minutes of oral argument, peppering them with questions about what this would mean. Does it include blood transfusions, vaccinations, et cetera? And then when it was the government's opportunity to present the case, the Solicitor General got hammered pretty quickly by Justices Roberts, Alito, and Scalia. So it was pretty clear sort of where the lines were going to fall. For me, I think that the question was that there were so many analytical steps. First, the corporation had to be determined to be a person under RFRA. Second, the burden had to be determined to be substantial. A sincerely held belief wasn't in question. And then third, the least restrictive means. So in my sort of optimistic view, I felt like there were so many prongs on which the Hobby Lobby exemption could fail that it may. That optimism ultimately did not play out in the ruling.
Okay. Well, that was a fantastic start for our show today. We're going to be talking with two other guests who come from opposite points of view on the subject, but it was great to have an expert on who could talk about this. So thanks for coming on today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of the program.
Thanks. So, for those of you who are just tuning in, this is Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm Matthew LeClaire, and today we are talking about the Hobby Lobby Supreme Court decision. We just wrapped up our first part with corporate law professor Ann Tucker from Georgia State University, and now we're bringing on two more guests to get into a discussion about the decision that goes beyond just corporate law. Abby Davenport is a free thought activist and an atheist in rural Oklahoma, and Carol Price is the author of Mystic Rhythms, The Philosophical Vision of Rush. She has created the MindVendor website and has recently founded MindVendor Books and now teaches kindergartners and first graders in rural North Carolina. So welcome both. Are you both there?
I'm here. This is Abby.
And I'm here. This is Carol.
Fantastic.
Hi, Carol. Hello.
That's how I like to start a show. So before we get into the Hobby Lobby decision itself, let's talk a little bit just about birth control, just so that we can get a feel for where you're both coming from. So what do you think about access to birth control in general? In other words, how should it be regulated, if at all? And are there any specific forms of birth control that either of you object to? So, Abby, why don't we start with you?
Okay, I'm very, very liberal with this. I think that women should have access to all forms of FDA-approved birth control and contraceptive methods. And I think that it should be covered under the Affordable Care Act, whether the corporations like it or not. I mean, I understand that they're people and that they have speech, and they must be men because their speech matters a whole heck of a lot more than mine does. And I've been kind of following this whole thing being in Oklahoma, well, forever, especially since 2012 when they had to, you know, drop their other insurance. So I found that rather interesting.
Okay, and my view is that I don't have anything against people having full access to birth control, except as with Hobby Lobby, if they are abortifacients, because I am anti-abortion, and I don't think anyone should be forced to payroll that if it goes against their conscience.
Okay, so in the context of the Hobby Lobby decision, Professor Tucker, who we just spoke to before, was talking a little bit about the specific forms of contraceptives that the plaintiffs in the Hobby Lobby case were arguing that that they shouldn't be responsible for. But it seems as if the science and medically is coming down on the side of saying that these are not abortion-causing pills. So what do you think about that, or how would you respond to that?
Well, I'm wondering in what respect that's meant, because in the case of an IUD, it prevents the implantation of a fertilized egg, and so it inevitably, you know, forces its demise, which means that it exits the womb, which is, by definition, I would think, an abortion. It's an aborted pregnancy. It did not take.
May I speak?
Go ahead, Abby.
Okay, Carol, I appreciate your opinion on that, and I would just like to note that IUDs are along the form of Mirena, especially. Actually, the way that that one works, yes, it is an implant, but it's a hormonal implant, and it actually prevents pregnancy by thickening the mucus around the cervix, so that's not actually true.
I'm sorry, but
on the Topper implant, I mean, I've read both ways on that one, but I read both very liberal and very right-wing views, and I'm looking at the numbers here, and I'm not finding the number on the CDC site that I was looking for. I will get back on that one. But as far as the Mirena, and there's another one that is also a hormonal IUD, that's just simply not the case.
So I think this actually is raising an interesting point because, you know, regardless of what the in the context of talking about specific forms of birth control, regardless of whether or not the science says one thing or another, there still clearly is a fundamental agreement, a fundamental disagreement among people in the United States who feel that certain forms of medication or certain procedures are either morally right or morally wrong. So that's a problem that we still have to deal with. And in the context of the Hobby Lobby case, how do you both feel about dealing with a situation where, on the one hand, the employer is, in some sense, forced to provide something that they feel morally against, but we also have people who are then forced to live under that particular viewpoint simply because they work for that company that holds that religious view. So in other words, how do you feel that we should manage the rights of the employee versus the rights of the employer?
There already exist alternatives. And I understand in listening to Professor Tucker that, you know, these organizations can file requests, you know, for them to, yeah, I'm not sure how to phrase it, but for them to seek assistance, I guess, through the government. And I understand that some are objecting to doing even that, but why not allow the individuals to file such a claim? Like there is a possible channel, is my suggestion.
Okay, go ahead, Abby.
From what I gathered there, it was my understanding that was not an option for individuals to do that. That needed to be done the other way.
It seemed like they filed an emergency injunction on that subject, and I guess we'll have to wait until it comes around.
Yeah, my suggestion is that it could be made possible that in principle, and that is what ought to be done in order to accommodate all parties. That in principle is not a difficult solution.
So in other words, you're saying that if it was such a case that the employee would be able to have just as easy access but not necessarily get it through their employers, that would be an acceptable alternative.
Yes, it would.
Okay.
Because I do feel that the employer's moral objections do trump the individual in this case.
Do you agree with that one, Abby?
Not in any way, shape, or form. I'm terribly sorry, Carol.
No, I understand.
frankly, and I look at this from many different angles. First and foremost, there's so many forms of birth control, like Professor Tucker mentioned, that are used medically that have absolutely nothing to do with contraception. Second,
oh sure, and that should be permitted.
Their morals matter, right? And their religion matters right up until their religious beliefs start affecting other people, and that is the meat and potatoes of this. They can do whatever they want. They can give as much money as they want. They can do all sorts of other things. They can close their businesses on Sundays. It'd be great if they quit buying all their products from China, which has one-child laws and state-sponsored abortions that are often coerced. But no, I don't believe in that at all. I don't think that that's right. I think that their rights come right up into the point where they are then violating somebody else's freedoms, which I think is what they're doing. No, I don't think that's what they're doing. I know that that's what they're doing with this law, and I do take great exception to that. I'm sorry if that comes off a bit abrupt.
No. I mean, I can see where you're coming from. Others would take it further and say that it's violating the rights of the unborn, when it comes to at least the abortifacients, which is, you know, where I'm coming from.
Yeah, well, and like I said, I'm still trying to Google here the statistics on the copper IUD, but as far as the Mirena, and they have another name that's also a hormonal IUD, that's just simply not the case.
Hmm.
And I'm still trying to quietly
Google
this here. So I'm on rural internet. You'll have to excuse me if my Midwest is showing.
No, that's perfectly okay. Yeah, exactly. I guess, well, we can probably then just extend it to something else and talk about it in the context of something like having a moral objection to inoculation against certain types of viruses that are included in an insurance plan provided by an employer. In that context, if someone truly has a moral objection, do you, Carol, feel that it still applies?
We are getting into a can of worms, of course, and that's a problem because in the first place, employers are the ones who are required to again bankroll all of this.
Right.
That system is the problem to begin with. We had choice before. We could have made it a private, more of a private thing that individuals get, just like car insurance and flood insurance. I mean, these are things that are free for the individual to do. But, we're kind of under the thumb of the government here, which is part of, which is really a great deal of what my objections are related to.
I assume you're talking about the Affordable Care Act itself?
Yeah.
I guess in that context, we're then getting to to another question, which is whether or not corporations should be responsible for providing health insurance to employees. And I suppose that if we're talking about that, then we would have to talk about ways in which people would be able to have access not only to health care, but to decent health care that actually helped them. And I would assume that the only way to do that would be for the employers to pay their employees a lot more money. But I'm not sure if there's any way around that.
Exactly. I'm a former insurance agent, and you would be amazed how much of your compensation is tied up in your benefits package.
Yeah.
And that includes your paid vacation, your sick leave, and a giant cost that is your health insurance. And as an insurance agent, and this is before the Affordable Care Act, the female, we're talking maternity coverage, any kind of female care, it's quite a lot of money that you add on to the policy every month. And that's for your reproductive health and your overall health as a lady. You know, we wouldn't want to cut out our mammograms and our pelvic exams and all of those things and different cancer screenings, you know. And I can't imagine wanting to, as a corporation, have to pay for that in an added benefits package, you know, forego the benefits package and let's, you know, rack up that person's salary quite a lot. Easily a third.
Why would they have to do both? I'm suggesting that
if they weren't going to do that, then they could pay for the benefits instead of paying for health insurance for that employee and all of their employees. They could just pay each employee more money.
Right. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
When you look at the percentage of your compensation is your benefits, your 401k. Your health insurance, all of those things that you receive from your employer under a group health insurance plan, it's huge.
I guess I kind of want to know from you, Carol, what is it that to you makes more sense about paying an equivalent sum of money to an employee so that they can then get health insurance versus an employer providing that health insurance through the benefits package that is then provided to the employee? Why do you feel that it should be different?
Because this allows individuals to choose what kind of coverage they need personally. and not have to pay for the range of requirements that employers have to pay for individuals. So, you know, I mean, it may be that that it could be required of the insurance companies that they have certain basic health rights, as they're sort of characterizing them as, covered, and, you know, provided, and, you know, or require individuals to cover themselves with certain things, just like they do with auto insurance. In principle, I'm not sure, or I don't understand what the problem would be in that case.
Hmm. Wouldn't that be paying twice if they pay already through a benefits package and then they have to turn around and buy all these other things that, especially because this affects women as far as something that they're having to do and they're taking and they're tending their own body. But this affects really entire families when you talk about meat and potatoes, their actual economics. You know, that's their groceries they're having to spend.
I'm saying that employers would pay a sum in addition to their salary that would be a supplement for them to buy. It would be a, I'm trying to think of the term, where they can go off and buy their own with the money that they're given.
Private insurance, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry I got confused there. I apologize for that. I thought you were saying that they have to buy that
on top of
their benefits.
You know, some people may have.
The corporations are paying for a large amount of their benefits, but then, you know, employees are paying into that benefits package every month.
Right. Well, and I guess part of the fear then, at least for me, is that, we're still struggling in this country to, require that, small and large corporations pay their employees enough that, that they can just simply live. As I understand it, we're still having a problem passing a national minimum wage of $10.10 per hour. So, I think that the steps required, especially in the House and Senate, to require companies to pay much more money to their employees so that they can get insurance, I don't know
how that would go. They're already paying that amount. I'm saying take that same money and not ask them to put in more.
Hmm.
But it's, you know, they're already paying in some cases half of what they pay, you know, half of their salaries is in medical benefits.
Right. And
give
so,
them
no,
that.
I said a third, and it depends on the benefits package.
Right.
But, yeah, as an insurance agent, I saw group companies, and about a third of their benefits or about a third of their compensation was in insurance. If you look at their overall benefits, depending on the company, it could be more, it could be less, depending on whether you get dividends or you have, like, a flexible spending account.
Right.
Or like a health savings account with that, your 401k, you have to look at your vacation, your sick leave. But yeah, I've seen companies that spend up to a third of that person's income is wrapped up in health insurance.
Wow.
Right, right.
So
well, wouldn't it be nice
really
to get that
health
cash?
Insurance plan,
yeah.
You know, that's a lot of money.
Yes.
I mean, and when you look at a company saying that, you know, we're going to cover everything for you, but you know this compensation that we pay for and then you also pay into, we're not going to give you a choice on that. We are deciding what you can and cannot purchase with your money and your compensation for your work.
Yeah, they're kind of put in that position.
Can't rightfully get into without some four-letter words.
Well, that's
and that's really not their employer's fault when it's been placed in their lap to be, you know, the stewards of other people's insurance.
Hmm.
When individuals can do it themselves, you know, they're responsible. We are as individuals expected to do less and less or be responsible for less and less. And this is what I think is causing a lot of the chaos. I mean, if we want to standardize something on such a large scale, you know, as the federal government, it does not account for all the individual needs and it didn't foresee so many crises that are coming about now that, you know, companies are being really hard hit with the new requirements, and it's really just been devastating to our economy and employment.
I'm not so sure that though that's entirely true, but I won't bother to challenge you on it too much because I don't know enough about it. But what I will say is
I'm not going to take the time to do that because that would be a lot. I strongly
so much
disagree.
Of this has a lot to do with everything.
From a perspective of being there.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the thing that I'm thinking now is that let's say that that it was to work out this way, that corporations would then be required to pay their employees a substantial amount of money, substantial enough that they would then be able to go out and purchase their own insurance. Mm-hmm. Would that then, in the Hobby Lobby case, would that then be able to follow over? So that, in other words, if the corporation is indeed still spending the same amount of money, whether it's going into their own insurance that they then provide to the employee, or they're providing the money directly to the employee and then the employee is getting their insurance, would the corporation then have the right under the Hobby Lobby case, or do you feel that they would have the right to tell the employee that they are not allowed to participate in an insurance plan that includes contraceptives, because
absolutely
in a sense
not.
It's why
no,
is it different?
It's none of their business.
Well, that's
it's none of their business now, and they're sticking their nose in it.
No, they're not sticking their nose in it. They're being asked
to be a party to it. No corporation needs to be in my lady bits or anybody else for that matter.
Right.
I mean, there's just nobody's bits that I think anybody else needs to be in unless they're.
But again, the government has put it in their lap. It makes it their business. And we could avoid that if it becomes the individual's business alone and they manage the whole thing.
I guess that's why I'm having a hard time seeing the difference, only because I do understand that the company, the corporation, is selecting to opt out of these certain contraceptives that are then provided to the employee. But if it's going to be the same amount of money and it's going to go to the employees in both cases,
yes.
And
I'll tell you the difference.
Yeah, go ahead.
When it is their responsibility, when they're providing, the employer is providing the insurance, they are certain under the old, before the ruling, that they would be a party to you know, the birth control that they're against. There is no, I mean, well, yeah, okay, it's not quite, well, yeah, I'm trying.
May I say
head.
Something it's while you
one.
Get that
yeah.
together, or I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I think this might help you get where you're going. And that's the only reason I say that, because a lot of what you've said so far sounds like exactly the reason why, as a country, we need single-payer health care. Because healthcare costs are absolutely through the roof and out of, I mean, just ridiculous. And what you've been talking about is basically that, single payer for all. And, you know, you don't really want it to be you want everything to be the individual's responsibility, but that's really not going to work. And we don't really want corporations to have their nose in it, because when they do, they say, oh, well, we can't cover this. Right now it's birth control. Next month it might be antidepressants, or, you know, Christian Scientists might be saying
right.
Any drugs ever.
We're
you
faced
know,
with two
let's
evils.
Get all the, let's get corporations and everything out of it. Let's go single payer and let's just be done.
Well,
does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. I disagree because, you know, we've seen where that goes in other countries and how long, you know, you wait for care, and how doctors are no longer interested in the profession. They're not getting paid properly. You know, it just has such ramifications when you set it up that way. Whereas there's the opportunity for competition among different insurance companies to provide better and better care. You know, competition, I think, is what helps things get better. You know, if you want progress, I think that's the way to approach it. Because once something's set up, and, you know, I mean, really, look at evidence, you know,
okay,
and
yeah,
I see it.
Because I can't find a single source that would cite that a single-payer program throughout the, in really any country is doing less than what we are now. We are pathetic as far as our health care systems and how we take care of our own people. So if you could cite me a single source and show me any evidence, I would gladly look at that. But right now, I have to really seriously
Canada,
look at that.
Canada, Scotland.
Well, right. I understand that there, you know, there are countries, but I've heard that argument before, and this kind of, I guess, gets to the heart of something that this show is often about, which is, you know, how do we tackle a problem when the situation is such that we're dealing with two very different sets of facts? Because right. from what I understand and from what I have read, it is true that that the United States has had a decline, and this is prior to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. We have been declining in providing health care to the American public, so much so that that there are other countries out there that are beating us in all kinds of ways. So we're both citing two.
Don't want to hear about either. I mean, we are the third world of healthcare.
Well, right, and that's why
we've got the best of everything to those who can't afford it. But for if you're middle class or you're, you know, less than that, screw you.
Right.
So
that's the thing, is what do we do about that? Because we can't really go anywhere if we literally have two different opposing sets of facts
on the same
info.
Well, conservative, you know, something that you don't hear much discussion about is the philosophical underpinnings of the conservative point of view, which has a lot to do with, you know, do we want a government that is like a parent that hands out everything, or do we run the country in such a way that people have to have responsibility? We have to scramble to get the kind of, let's marshal our efforts to get an educational system that teaches critical thinking skills, that arms people with the ability to dope these things out for themselves. I mean, we've got a party that is dangling these goodies in front of people, create and weakening their character
Weakening their character? Are you seriously? Pardon me. I'm sorry, Carol. You keep going on for a very long period of time, I've already forgotten half your points that you tried to make here.
It wasn't that long. It just always seems like it.
Responsible and, you know, personally responsible. Can we ask them, you know, that they regulate corporations as well? Because it seems like there's an awful lot of responsibility being asked of people when corporations are allowed to absolutely just dump on everything, and we the people are the ones that are cleaning it up. Not only that, the corporations get to dump on everybody, and they get tax breaks on top of it.
It's all not perfect. No, I'm not praising the corporations here in what I'm saying to you now.
No, you're talking about everybody having to have personal responsibility.
Okay, well, no, I didn't finish my point.
Huge leeway, and they have no responsibility. And the people that end up fixing things are the government and the taxpayers. So why not let the government and the taxpayers work for the taxpayers for once? In which case, like this, healthcare. And if you'd like, I would love to go over some of the world's best healthcare systems for you, country by country. I have the top 36 in the world, if you're curious.
Okay, yeah, well, I would have to know what the criteria is for best.
Well, and Carol, because it has been kind of a 2-to-1 game today, and because we're running low on time, I'll give you the final word on this because we're running out of time. Go ahead.
Okay, well, continue to say about a solution is to really marshal our efforts to create an environment where the standards of education, I mean, we want to lift people up so they can think for themselves and make wise decisions and become moral captains of industry. I know that sounds very idealistic, but we have really very little effort in that direction, relatively speaking. And I think, all our problems are a result of poor thinking. poor reasoning. And I think we need more education, philosophical education, and I think those would begin to help our problems. We would be able to debate in a more civil way in public, and I don't refer to our present conversation, but rather what you hear a lot on public TV and cable television and all the rest.
This is definitely a conversation that is far, far from over, but we are over with time. So I thank you both, Abby and Carol, for coming on today to talk about this.
Well, thank you for giving me the chance to sound off.
No problem.
Absolutely grandstanding.
Yep. All right. So that was it for today's Equal Time for Free Thought. Thank you to our engineer, Sean Rhodes, who has been managing to put on three different people on the air, including myself making it four. This was Equal Time for Free Thought. If you want to listen to our program again, you can visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Remember to tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.
But all I've seen of this old world is a bed and a doctor bill. Cause now I've got the pill. All these years I've stayed at home while you had all your fun. And every year that's gone by, another